Blog Talk Radio.
Movie Geeks United. I am your co-host Jamie, and our co-host Jerry is here with us too.
Hey Jamie, and how you doing? And hi to all of our listeners.
We are thrilled to bring you the show tonight. It's going to be a great one. It's going to be a very different one. Let me tell you what we have on the show tonight. We have a little later on the show, we're going to welcome Joan Brooker Marks. She is the director of a new documentary that just came out on DVD. It's called Larry Flint, The Right to Be Left Alone. So we're going to be discussing Larry Flint. And then we're going to welcome the screenwriter of a film that opened up this weekend called An American Carol. Her name is Myrna Sokoloff. And in between, we're going to be reviewing Religulous.
We're going to review that? We're going to actually take what I... Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going to ask your opinion on it. And you can
flattered.
This is going to be a politically charged show, so we thought that we'd open up the show in a very fun manner.
You couldn't ask for, actually, in all seriousness, if I may, a better way to open up the show. Definitely, I will say this, and I said this to someone last night, I wish they had made movies like this when I was in high school. Not that I have anything against the John Hughes movies that came out in my time, but this movie just hit all the right notes.
Yeah, it's a breath of fresh air, this movie that we're going to be discussing this first segment. I just want to let everyone know that our chat room is open. If you're listening out there live, you can click the chat available icon on the homepage there and be taken directly to our chat room where movie geeks are conversing back and forth, and it's great, passionate fun in there. So are you all set to get the show started, my friend?
I've been ready since you first announced the lineup.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's
Here's
do it.
What Lisa Schwartzbaum had to say about the new film Nicanora's Infinite Playlist. The marvelous, magical boy meets girl in the city that never sleeps romantic comedy Nicanora's Infinite Playlist is a revolutionary movie disguised as a familiar story. A generous chunk of that credit, of course, deservedly goes to the film's screenwriter, Loreen Scafaria. The film follows stars Michael Cera and Kat Dennings in the title roles as they spend a life-changing night together in the wild, unpredictable setting of Manhattan. Here's the trailer to this film.
This is Nick. He's a sensitive musician.
I'm not going. We have a gig, Nikki.
I don't want to go. I'm taking a mental health day.
Who's bad at relationships?
Hey, Tris, it's Nick.
I just wanted to talk to you. You know, I think we both said some things we didn't mean, like when you broke up with me on my B-day.
This is Nora.
Okay, everybody in.
She always plays by the rules.
You have to promise me that you won't get drunk tonight.
But tonight...
Nora, alone again?
I came here with someone.
Who?
She's going to break them.
Would you be my boyfriend for 5 minutes?
What?
Please, go ahead. Okay,
Nick, Nora, how do you guys, like, know each other?
We're the same dentist.
Yeah, he's good.
Are you Tristan, Nick?
I gotta get my friend at home.
We'll take the drunk mess home.
Yay!
You two go have fun.
If you touch one hair on her head, I will kill all of you.
Sorry, I'm being carried.
Oh.
Oh, she'll be okay.
Are you off duty?
This isn't a cab.
Are you off duty?
It's not a cab, my friend, I promise you.
Yeah.
I'm not a cab. I'm not a cab.
I love you so much, it's retarded.
Okay, last stop.
What about you?
8:50. Charged a little extra for the cleanup.
The story lost the girl.
What? What?
Start fire!
Where are you?
I found Jesus.
What?
Jesus!
He's much taller in person.
He's hung up on Tris.
Let's just say we're not the biggest fans of his ex, and we think you're the one.
Hey, Dave, you know the blow dryer?
Laura, come on.
Hey, what's wrong?
This doesn't concern you.
Push me again.
Oh, and what?
That's it!
Awesome. Awesome night.
Infinite Playlist.
It's a great pleasure to welcome to the show the screenwriter of Nick Nora's Infinite Playlist, Miss Lorene Scafaria. Let me bring her up here. Lorene, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to me a little bit about, I understand you were writing pretty vigorously from a very early age, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Fortunately for my parents, they had to sit through many a childhood play. Yeah, I was sort of I was putting up some like Max Fisher-esque kind of shows in rural New Jersey.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. My first play was it was called A Straight Flush, and it was about businessmen in an office. It was trying to be David Mamet real hard, and it starred like four other 17-year-old boys.
How old were you when you wrote that?
I was 16, and that was ridiculous. That was just I was too old for it. But and yet, you know, I shouldn't have. It just was such a ridiculous setting. I found the VHS of it recently, and found a VHS player to play it, and I started it, and it starts with these two 17-year-old kids playing 40-year-old men. And one of them is sharpening a pencil for a long time, and then he says, "You know what Sharky said?" The other guy says, "What?" And he says, "He said if you can't make a deal in two martinis, then you don't belong in the business." So I lost it. I laughed so hard and just shut it off. I'm afraid of what that's like. Yes, it's not bad. It's not bad.
So Mamet, was Mamet influential for you? I mean, obviously starting to tinker with playwriting. Mamet, and who were the other kind of influences for you?
Yeah, Mamet and Sam Shepard. I tried that for a little while. I mean, I liked some more absurd stuff at that time. I liked a little these Richard Foreman plays and.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it was mostly Mamet. I just liked cursing a whole lot, and so
who doesn't?
I tried real hard to do that for a time, and then I put up this play in New York after I moved there after college, and I was 21, and it was a little bit more, you know, of a relationship play, mm-hmm. and I adapted that. That became my first screenplay, actually. So. Yeah, very big adaptation from my own play to my own screenplay. But then I never wrote a play again, ever.
Yeah,
completely sold out as soon as it happened. So,
well, were films a part of your vernacular during these young years when you were tinkering with playwriting?
Yeah, definitely. More so than theater even was. It was just I just liked dialogue a whole lot. So. Mm. Writing plays was much more my speed at that time. But no, yeah, I mean, you talked about John Hughes, and that was certainly a bit of an influence in the back in my day. But no, I'd say it was a little bit more like Woody Allen and and people that growing up. So I can't say I had such great taste. I mean, you know, I own Swing Kids. I have that.
Kenneth Rana, thank you. Kenneth Rana will probably get on here and say thank you so much.
Right? His German accent was perfect.
It was.
Spot on.
So we love Woody Allen on here. So you're writing both for the stage and screen and adapting one from the other, as you did too. You mentioned the dialogue, and dialogue is certainly prevalent on the stage, but screen is such a visual kind of medium. Tell me some of the differences and challenges between writing for both mediums.
I mean, with a play, you don't have that to fall back on at all. So there's a challenge there in just keeping momentum with just, you know, it's definitely a tell and not a show as much. So there's something to switch up there. I mean, I felt that kind of pressure with adapting Nick and Nora from, you know, a novel that I loved when I read it, and I completely wanted to do it, but I was still absolutely terrified with what to do with it. Everything was so internalized, and you know, there's these great characters, and it's more about like, what do you leave out? What can I possibly add to this? You know, it's definitely scary, but.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you can show it instead of tell it, I suppose that's good. It's still a challenge for me. You know, there's all kinds of things you can use: flashbacks, voiceover. I was pretty caught up in a lot of devices when I started, and I don't know. Shedding that seems good, I think.
Well, you said that you talked about the book. You read the book and fell in love with it. I think about 4 years ago for Nick and Nora. What were some of those qualities of the book that spoke to you?
You know, I grew up in New Jersey, and so there was just an immediate reaction to their time and place. Even some of the references, I wasn't sure if it was a period piece at first. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if it took place in the 80s or anything. I mean, or the 90s, there were references to Green Day and... Mm-hmm. So I immediately fell in love with the place, and their voices are so strong. The authors of the book, Rachel Cohn and David Levithan, you know, they wrote alternating chapters, and she would write Nora's parts and he would write Nick's. And I found that just kind of fascinating that they'd sort of paint each other into these corners. And when I talk to them about it, you know, they'd disappoint each other with like what she would have Nora react to, you know, what her reaction would be, how Nick would suddenly become so pathetic in the book, and you'd hear his thoughts, and you know, just to crawl inside their heads during that, and how then it affected the relationship, you know, over the course of the night. I just thought that was great. I definitely just responded to that overall tone, you know, that one night of your life. And I closed that book and I absolutely cried and just wanted to be 16. I wanted to be back in New York. I just missed everything. And just that feeling of like first love and all that hope that kind of comes with that. So, I closed the book very satisfied, and I just sort of wanted to get anywhere near that feeling for a movie, you know?
Yeah, there's something I want to ask you, because we've talked about several things leading up to this. The co-authors that wrote this book, and they would go back and forth between the male and the female character, and then even coming off from mentioning Woody Allen, who was himself so exceptional at writing female characters.
Right.
When you're and you've grown up admiring very very strong kind of masculine writers and Mammoth and the others that you mentioned.
Yeah.
I mean, was that kind of the grounding for being able to write male characters as well as female characters, to understand them both and dramatize them as well? As the
sure.
Other?
I think that, I mean, it must come from, if it's showing at all, it must come from somewhere, I guess, in my experience. I was just such a tomboy growing up that I had a lot more male friends than female friends.
Yeah.
Throughout my life, actually, I think some of my closest friends are guys, and I think what's amazing about them is they sort of they're just more honest. They're just a little bit more honest, and for me anyway, I much prefer that. I want to know if I'm being an asshole, call me an asshole. Like, just like do it,
we
and then we'll be okay.
We try to be honest. I can't say that we're always honest, but we try.
You try, of course. But I find that like male friends, you know, seem to be able to tell each other even more so. Like,
mm-hmm.
And even in trying to write this film, it's like, do not talk to this girl about Tris. Like, just, you know, like just they hold you accountable a little bit more, which I appreciate. And, I don't know. My father and brother were just complete influences in my life, and I sort of remember at an early age just like watching their plight, you know, watching their plight as men. I thought it was just fascinating. I don't know. There's just such a different mentality there, and in the relationship to work and the relationship to themselves. And so,
yeah,
I guess I was always fascinated with very masculine stories growing up. Even the films that I watched, you know, I mean, Scorsese's films were just, they're just so meaty. It's ridiculous. And,
That's a good word for meaty.
Meaty.
That's a very good film.
They're bolognese, you know. They're just very strong. I like that. And so, and you know, I can't say that I don't love writing female characters either. I mean, there's something so much more complex going on for Nora than Nick, in a way. When the book starts, when the movie starts, you know, he's wounding a broken heart, but it's not necessarily something that you think he can't get over, you know. And yet, that's wrong to say too. There's so many guys I know at 30 years old who are still trying to get over their high school girlfriend. So
maybe
I'm wrong. Maybe it is a
hi,
wound,
my name but... is hi, my name is Jamie. I'm one of those guys.
what I really thought was great about this film, and I really, as much as I like the John Hughes movies that I saw, I grew up in the 80s, mid to late 80s. I think your film really hit all the right notes. It's kind of, you know, the writing is very good, the dialogue is very good, and the characters, you can relate to them very easily. They're not like, in the 80s, I think we still put up people on pedestals, and we put them in these incredible, outrageous situations, but here, I could easily relate to them.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
it was
that's
just beautiful.
Great. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I think, like, nostalgia must play a part in all of that, probably. I mean... Yeah, I don't know. You know, you have those crazy nights and, I don't know, you have those outrageous situations, but you sort of cause them, you create them for yourselves, you know. And New York today isn't exactly what it was in the 80s, which I love in New York 80s movies. Everyone,
of course.
You're mugged immediately.
Well,
you're robbed and raped later. Like, it's just bound to happen. I mean, it
were you... influenced, and I know the novel you obviously took from that, but were you influenced by, like, Scorsese's After Hours or anything?
Yeah,
like
I love
that?
After Hours,
okay.
Definitely. I mean,
okay.
And you almost can't make that movie today. I mean, it's just so wonderfully episodic. It just is, you know. But you care so much about this guy. and yet, I don't know what it is about his face. You just don't mind that much that all this stuff is happening. You almost know that he'll be better for it.
Right, right.
So there's something there, too, that I like about what sort of Nick and Nora go through is, you know, you just know they'll be better for it. They're fighting now. They're, you know, they're completely insecure. They're not having a good moment, whatever.
No, they're not having a good moment, that's for sure. But what I like is of Kat Dennings, who really in this film, I mean, I loved her in Charlie Bartlett and The House Bunny, but she really gets to finally take the center stage here, and she's excellent.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She's really superb against Michael Cera.
Yeah, they're a wonderful balance for each other, and they're kind of like that in real life, too. She really wants to take care of him. She's very maternal towards him. It's really sweet. And, she absolutely shines in this. And I remember seeing her audition tape and just knowing that she just absolutely, she reminded me of what Winona Ryder was like, you know, and with, I mean, these just like doe eyes and absolutely beautiful. And yet, you know, you could kind of see how brittle she could be underneath that sort of tough exterior. I just think she's amazing as a person and certainly as Nora. And, thank God. Thank God she came along. Because it's just such a tough character to play because you sort of have to fall in love with her over the course of the movie. It's not the same as Michael Cera, who's just as soon as he walks into frame, you're in love, you're hooked in, you know, you care, you don't want to see him suffer too much. And,
right.
You know, with her, I think it actually takes you're kind of along in Nick's head in that way. You're sort of
you
watching.
Are.
You're with him, and you're kind of just falling in love with her. And at that point, when she actually drops her guard, which I think is really beautiful, when they're just there talking and DeSalca, and she starts. I don't know that for me is when it starts to happen, and then of course she becomes very vulnerable in front of him. Yeah. So, she's amazing.
Let's take a phone call. We have a caller on the line with a question. 702 area code. Go right ahead.
Hello, Lauren. I just got back from the movie. I thought it was outstanding. I loved the movie.
Thank you so much.
I thought the dialogue was really good, and I thought that it was actually a pretty funny movie overall. And the gum was just hell freaking hysterical. Was the gum in the book? Is that
no.
basically how?
No, I don't think it was. I don't think there's any reference really. Maybe it swaps back and forth at some point, but no, it wasn't this runner in the book at all, and it wasn't. The thing was that actually Caroline going missing didn't happen in the book. So the entire subplot of going and finding her and watching her sort of stumble around the city and having Nick and his friends continue to have to be a part of the story wasn't in the book either. So that was, you know, certainly sort of to help the thrust of the story, but all of that was, a little bit of reinvention.
Yeah. Also, I was going to ask you about the studio scene and all that as well. Do you know was the recording in the actual book of them doing it?
No, it wasn't. It was a totally different sort of moment for Nora in the book. In the book, there was no reference to. Oh no, there was. I'm sorry. There was reference to her never really getting off with Tal, her boyfriend, but it wasn't this like runner for Nora's character that she had sort of never had an orgasm. And so in the book around at that moment when they finally hook up, it was in like a hotel vending machine ice room. and it was Nora, giving Nick pleasure. It was quite the opposite. And although it was a very sexy scene to read and, you know, good stuff all around, I just kind of felt like it wasn't exactly, I don't know, it wasn't exactly cinematic, certainly. And I wasn't sure how we'd get away with that, but also it didn't exactly sum up, you know, Nora sort of shedding her wall a little bit and being vulnerable in front of someone else. I don't know. It didn't exactly fit.
All of a sudden, I feel like we're already talking to our Larry Flint guest.
I was going to mention that it was actually very cool that they ended up doing it in the Electric Lady Studios. That was just like awesome. And
yeah, I can't believe we got
to film it. Was hilarious
too. Oh yeah, I can't believe we got to film in that place. That was, you know, certainly at the time we were just saying Dad's Recording Studio, and then
right. It
became Electric Ladyland, which was just, you know, such a plus. It was amazing.
All right, Mark, thanks so much for calling in, buddy.
Oh, thanks a lot. I love the movie. I thought the writing was absolutely superb.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I hope to see if you write another movie. I'd love to see it.
Oh, thank you so much. And check out the book. It's really great. It really is.
Okay,
thanks.
Will do. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
On the set, were you a constant presence? Were you welcomed
no.
on the set?
Goddamn writer's strike was going on.
Oh,
I was
oh
there.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it really was a drag. I set up this entire, like, New York trip. I was so excited. And I thought I was just going to be there the whole time trying to learn something. And then I think I was there only for the first week and a half. And then the writer's strike happened, and suddenly I was picketing outside of CBS. It was strange.
Oh, wow.
It was strange. So, I got to go back for my cameo. I'm in a minute. I'm making out in the back of a Yugo in it.
Oh, that's you. Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Ridiculous. So,
cool.
So I got to go back for that. I got to go back and make out with Seth Meyers for a couple of days, and that was...
Well, yeah, if only all of us were that lucky.
If only. Fred Armisen has had his day, so...
Right, yes.
I get mine. Yeah.
So you did very well this weekend. It opened Friday, and here we are Sunday evening. How do you feel now compared to how you felt Thursday night, say?
Thursday night was the premiere, and it felt good, but it was... I don't know. I was still caught up in and press and that kind of thing. And I don't know. I was still sort of sweating. For some reason, Friday I felt much more at ease. I guess I don't care enough about box office. I suppose I should. You know, I mean, we did well, but you know, everybody sets such high expectations. You know, it's just always so hard to please yourself. And then, you know, we did this. We did a limo theater crawl. Me and my closest 15 friends. We went in this ridiculous limo and drove from theater to theater and sort of poked our heads in and looked at people watching it. And that was possibly the best moment of my life. There was a room full of 200 people that have no idea how happy they made some Jersey trash.
That's what's so great. This is the important thing. People are walking out and they're of this film and they're elated. I mean, they love the movie.
That's great.
And that's how it's going to survive. I mean, it's really reaching people. Do you have any projects coming up?
Oh yeah. I wrote this script called Man and Wife for Universal that'll hopefully get going, about an immigration officer, and I'll be directing soon, hopefully.
Oh, congratulations!
Thanks. Yeah, I set up this project with Mandate, who did Nick and Nora, I'm really excited about it. It's sort of an apocalyptic love story.
Wow.
It's called Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, which is this Chris Cornell song that I used to listen to.
Oh, it's a great song.
I love that song. And
yeah,
so
Chris Cornell is awesome.
I love him. I've just been noodling the idea for a long time and was just so excited that Mandate would have the vote of confidence. So
this really is from your own script?
Yeah, this is my own script, and I set it up as a pitch, so just starting to really get into the script now, and I'm really excited about that. And then I recorded an album.
My gosh,
you are all over the place.
It's ridiculous. It's got to stop.
No, don't stop.
it should stop. I recorded an album. I hadn't lived with a piano for 10 years, and then I got a piano and just started writing music again, and didn't really want to write a script again for a long time. But then during the writer's strike, I got to finish up recording it, and I don't know. I don't know what it'll amount to at all, but MySpace page has occurred. That's about the bulk of it. I did show without throwing up, so I may actually work up the nerve to do another one. But
I'm sure it's fantastic. Do you find that you have to be in a certain mood to write songs?
Certainly. I think that I sort of write the lyrics and the music at the same time, which mm-hmm. I think is okay. It sort of informs the other a little bit. So, yeah, I definitely I've been feeling a little bluesy. I've been feeling a little bluesier lately.
Yeah.
For me,
I feel like I write best when I'm songs when I'm depressed, and
yeah.
I can't. Maybe you have a similar experience. If I have to think about it too much, it's usually an awful song. It feels almost like you're channeling. It's, you know, it has to just come to you somehow.
That's why I think like lyrics and music just happen. They're just happening. You sit down and you're in a particular funk or whatever. I think you're right. I think that's the way I feel about even scripts. This came very naturally just because I know this. I know their world. You know, when I'm trying to like have war correspondent characters riffing, it's a little harder, you know. So writing what you know, and if you're writing a song, it's sort of what you know in that moment. So you got to put yourself in a mood and I think go from there.
Well, we wish you the very best of luck with all of these projects.
Yes, we do.
Whenever these come to light or come to fruition, please come back and talk to us because you are just delightful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is great.
Thank you so much, Lorraine. Well, we'll talk to you soon, hopefully.
Okay, talk soon. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, she's a delightful girl. Lorraine Scafaria, the screenwriter of Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. It opened this weekend. It did well. People are walking out, and they're really exhilarated by the experience. So definitely go check that out. And Jerry, you liked it very much.
I did. It was very enjoyable. It was very very charming, uplifting. I definitely recommend it to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, and we didn't even get into, I mean, her being a musician, we didn't even get into the music that so defines particularly that genre of film. I mean, the music is the real voice of the youth in a lot of these films, a different character almost. But
I think you're absolutely right, and I did not know that this was written in a novel. I didn't even know this was a novel until a couple of weeks ago based on a young adult novel, but it was written in the 90s. So, and the music, you know, you look at the soundtrack and listen to the music, it's totally different from the music from the 90s in the sense that she mentioned Green Day. And it's like, I guess one of the bands I know off the top of my head in the film is My Vampire Weekend, and then I get lost after that because I'm not up on the, you know, the zeitgeist of the music of the youth today. But
yeah.
You know, after that name, I'm just like, I have no idea who these bands are. I like the music. I'd actually go out and buy the soundtrack, to be very honest with you. I enjoyed it that much.
I'll say it again. I mean, I still listen to Barry Manilow, so what do I know about what the youth?
Oh, that's all right. No one's going to give you. If anyone gives you a hard time about that, they need it. They need me to come over and drop kick them.
My entire life, people will give me a hard time about that. So, no one more than Chris, my best friend. So, you know.
Oh my God! Okay.
Comes with the territory.
Okay.
Okay, we're all set for our next guest. She's waiting patiently on the line. We very much appreciate it. Larry Flint, The Right to Be Left Alone, is a new documentary now available on DVD. It documents the journey of hustler publisher Larry Flint as he courts controversy and endures various forms of punishment in his quest to preserve our freedom of speech. It's a wonderful film, and here is the trailer for that film.
Since I've been dragged through most of the courts, in prison, shot, paralyzed, defending the First Amendment, I figured I could give you a view from the trenches.
They feel very much threatened by Hustler magazine and by me because it's one thing they can't control.
That really made Larry an overnight sensation because the world couldn't believe that somebody could publish a magazine and get 25 years in prison for it.
First of all, there's only two kinds of people that don't like pornography. Those who don't know what they're talking about and those who don't know what they're missing. Freedom of the press is only important if it's offensive. If we're not going to offend anybody, we don't need protection of the First Amendment.
It's really almost beyond incredible that we've reached a point where a porno publisher is driving American politics.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
He screwed up everything. I can't believe my wildest dreams that we elected such an idiot as our president.
If people are willing to send their kids over there to fight and die, they deserve the right to have a free press to monitor the war.
Well, I think religion has caused more harm than any other idea since the beginning of time. Every significant war since the beginning of time has all been fought over religion. They think that what we're doing is exploiting for women, it's demeaning. I've never had one say she felt she was being exploited.
I see this as one of the most grave periods of our history as a nation. I think the American people are going to have to accept that many of the civil rights and individual liberties that they gained have been placed in jeopardy.
The only thing that I'm trying to do is pass on first-hand knowledge, my ideas, and my information. Feel free to use any or all or none of them.
Yeah, it's a sensational documentary.
Can I say something real quick?
Okay, go ahead.
I agree with every word that Larry Flint said in that trailer.
That's true.
I'm not. You think I'm joking? You think I'm just trying to?
I don't think you're joking. I know exactly who you are.
Okay, thank you.
Might I introduce our guest now?
Mm-hmm.
I'll introduce.
My
our guest.
Pleasure.
Yes. Please welcome to the show the co-producer and director of Larry Flint, The Right to Be Left Alone, Ms. Joan Brooker Marks. Joan, are you with us?
Yeah, I am. Thank you so much for having me on. I was really
thank
enjoying
you for being
that.
On.
It's a real pleasure.
It's a pleasure for us too. This is your first film, is that correct?
First feature documentary.
Okay.
I did two small documentaries before.
Okay. Tell me about that journey leading up to this, and when films started to become a part of your life, and was the documentary form a major part of that for you?
It was just a sort of organic thing. I initially worked in Los Angeles as a television writer. Of course, before that and out of college, I was going to be an Academy Award winning actress, like everybody else. and that ended really quickly. And I got into television writing, lived in Los Angeles, subsequently moved to New York, and I started teaching writing at the School of Visual Arts. And in the course of that, it was during when I initially started, digital technology was just exploding. Avid, Final Cut Pro, digital cameras, and I'd always loved documentaries, but I was always very intimidated by the technology. So I had this opportunity to learn along with my students. And was very much encouraged by my colleagues. And so in 1999, I had this idea of filming these four 90-year-old women that played Mahjong every Thursday and drank a lot of J&B. And my colleagues said, do it.
That's quite a combo.
Yeah, they were great. And so I just did it, not really knowing what I was doing, but I was asking my students to do it, so I just plunged in. And as it turned out, it was in somewhat of a surprise to us, I'll tell you, was rather successful.
Yeah.
For a short doc. And then I did another one about some golfers in East Hampton. And then I felt I was really ready to tackle a feature, because that's a whole different thing, particularly in terms of editing. Because these profiles are nonlinear, so there's not really an inherent beginning, middle, and an end. So it's almost like you're creating a mosaic, and it's very tough.
Yeah, I would imagine so. That's part of what fascinates me about it. When you go into a feature documentary production, do you have an agenda, or do you just let it fly where it flies?
Well, in the case of a profile, that is, or when you're trying to construct a condition, I consider that nonlinear. And I think you have a visual look in your head. I think you know what you want to evoke out of the people you're interviewing. But you always have to be prepared for surprises and the unexpected. And I always know what it is I want to do. I mean, Larry Flint is exactly what I wanted to do, but the assembling of that, it's so delicate and so delicate to keep it moving and interesting and compelling and sort of create its own architecture so that it has a foundation that you can play with and move in and out of.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. It is the most exciting thing I've ever done. It is writing, actually, in the editing room.
I think, yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. You said that Larry Flint was the subject that you definitely wanted to tackle for this feature.
I had intended on doing, believe it or not, a feature documentary on the trafficking of women from Ukraine. And was in pre-production for that with another colleague of mine. And then my husband came to me and said, what do you think about doing a documentary on Larry Flint? And I went, if he's good to go, I'm good to go. So I left the trafficking of women and just jumped on board with Larry Flint, which is, there is a kind of irony there, I think.
Well, there is, but at least, you know, if you did anything in that part of the world, I'm afraid Putin would come after you. So I'm glad you did Larry Flint, just for your own safety.
You know what, me too, because subsequently I found out it's quite dangerous, and you don't just drop into the Ukraine and ask people to talk about trafficking.
I would advise against it.
Yeah, so
I think it ended up being a good choice.
I need to ask a question, just on a general.
Sure.
That you're a woman. How did you? What do you think of Mr. Flint? I mean,
what'd you think of him prior and after meeting him? How did that change?
Yeah.
For you? Yeah.
Well, I knew him somewhat before, in an acquaintance kind of way.
I adore him. I mean, he's truly a gentleman. He's really sweet. You know, he's not crude in private or anything like that. He's just, you know, kind of a very interesting man. But I was so appalled at the impeachment process of Bill Clinton and what was going on there that when he outed Livingston, and then I got to know more of what he did. I mean, to me, I guess what it is none of us is any one thing. And the things that I love about Larry are the fact that I think he's done more for the First Amendment in the last three decades than any single individual.
He took a bullet. He took a bullet for all of us.
Took a bullet, Yeah, the porn, I mean, Hustler magazine is pretty raw, but when I was looking at Carter, I got rather inured to it. I mean, I've probably seen more vaginas than anybody besides Larry. I mean, just going through these magazines to find the cartoons, it just was like, stop, I can't take it anymore.
I used to live next door to the Flint building when I lived in Los Angeles, so, I mean...
Oh, the one
on La Cienega? Yes, we're on La Cienega and, in Wilshire. Yeah, I used to live right next door to that.
Well, you know, the Beverly Hills people didn't quite like Larry moving into their neighborhood.
No, they hated it. I don't know why. I mean, I thought it was the greatest thing that ever happened to the area, but that's just
right.
Me.
Yeah,
but I didn't know you lived next. Off,
no, I
all,
did.
All,
that was.
Everyone has seen more vagina than I have. This is
no,
upsetting.
No. Hey, I would have taken a job with Slim Aviation magazine. Okay, so.
God, it's just crazy.
You know, the film is fascinating. There's so many revelations about Larry Flint. It's surprising because obviously there was a great Milos Forman feature film,
right.
You know, in the 90s about him. But to tackle this subject now, was it a lot about the political climate of today? Why the profile of this man is more necessary than it ever has been?
Completely, and I'll tell you, the being able to do this film perfectly coincided with how I was feeling political. So I was able, and I've been criticized for it, of course, but I was able to make the kind of political film and make the statement that I wanted to make through Larry Flint's lived life, and that was just a wonderful gift to me.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead, I'm sorry, ma'am.
No, go ahead.
Well, a couple of the points in the documentary, obviously he was very outspoken in the courts, and he very much challenged that system, and of course the tragic shooting that occurred.
Yeah.
But also I really responded to how he challenged the morality of our political leaders. And if you could discuss just a little bit for the listeners out there that might not be aware, was it a $100,000 reward for whoever could point out immoral activity?
One million. And that's still operable.
Oh, yeah.
It's still operable. He recently did it. I mean, he was quasi-responsible for the Vitter outing. Senator Vitter from Louisiana.
What about Larry Craig?
Well, that wasn't him, although he jumped on it. You know,
I would have thought right there that would have been the perfect thing. I mean, that would have exposed the whole party to a level of hypocrisy.
Yeah, I mean, he's on top of all of it, and he's got apparently some gems, but he's got to be really careful because he has to vet these people completely, just like with Livingston. It has to be 100% because he comes under such scrutiny.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the whole revelation of how he really began the trend of reporters embedded with the troops. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they didn't want, and they sort of, they really successfully barred, I think, the press in the Desert Storm, the first one, or Desert, the first Bush, the Kuwaiti War. You know, because they had Schwarzkopf up there with his it was like a sitcom, you know. I mean, it was sort of managed press. And
right.
they didn't really want people in there. And Larry sued. And he, by the way, he was the only one that did. He had no amicus briefs filed on his behalf when he brought that to the appellate division in I think it was Virginia, but back east. You know, he did that all alone. And no other mainstream media, no organization, not CBS, not NBC, not CNN, not ABC, was protesting the lack of access to the battlefield. None of them. And so
yeah.
Larry fought that one alone. And as it says in the film, the government could see, Rumsfeld et al. Could see that Larry was winning, and that the judge was really going to rule in their favor, and that's when embedding reporters came in. And we've
yeah.
all seen those.
mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's true. It made a major impact. And he continues to make a major impact. You film him as he's speaking to different groups.
Right.
What do people yearn from him? What kind of insight do they hope to glean from him?
Well, I think most people are just really fascinated by his life and his life story and what he's done. I think that the most receptive audiences he has are actually when he travels to colleges and speaks at law schools, which he has done at Oxford, Ann Arbor, Yale, Princeton, Harvard, where we went, I think George Washington, UCLA, USC, he's NYU, he's been everywhere. And it's interesting to me because to students in their 20s, or, you know, early 20s to late 20s, to them he's an icon, he's iconic. The fact that he's a pornographer just doesn't matter to them.
Right.
They're crazy about him, for the most part.
Yeah.
He's filled a void that Hunter S. Thompson, you know, has left, obviously, that when he,
yeah.
he's like, it sounds to me, when you're talking about the college tours and everything, he's filled that void.
Yeah. I mean, he really fulfills something in these, particularly these young law students and kids that they don't really, you know, get in sort of traditional education. And I also might add that his, the Falwell decision, Falwell versus Flint, which he won,
right.
is in Constitution classes and First Amendment classes, is the definitive case that they teach. That
yeah.
is the seminal case that they teach, the Falwell versus Flint. Because
right.
that was a really, really serious challenge. Because if Larry had have lost that, all kinds of parity would have been in jeopardy because the decision was that they awarded Falwell, $250,000 for hurting, for Larry's, for hurt feelings.
Right.
And so it you know, not for libel, but for hurt feelings. So if that was upheld, that means anybody anywhere could sue anybody for writing anything or any kind of political cartoon for hurting someone's feelings. And at that point, when it did get to the Supreme Court, New York Times and the media organizations did file Friends of Court briefs on that.
Yeah.
They did support Flint on that.
It's such a perfect – he's such a perfect subject to bring about these First Amendment issues because – because he's so polarizing because so many people are kind of put off by his primary business, which is Hustler, and he goes to say, he said, you know, the First Amendment doesn't mean anything unless it's offensive. You know, we wouldn't need that protection if we were all okay with everything that was being said. I mean, that's what makes our country so unique and special, is that you have
yeah.
the right to say these things and challenge conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the film and how you've – the journey of getting it out there and who you've shown it to and what kind of response you've received from it.
Well, you know, I was a bit under the gun in 2007 because I realized that it was an election year film. Well, actually, in the winter of 2006. So as I was approaching 2007, excuse me, I knew that – we really needed to get out. And I was very fortunate that I had had a relationship with Full Frame Documentary Festival. I had shown a film there, and I sent it out in a rough cut, and they chose it right off the bat, which was fabulous. And it gave it its debut. And then we were accepted again. They only choose, I think, 12, only chose 12 features for the International Documentary Association Showcase, which is also Academy Award qualifying. And that was a week's run at the Arclight in Los Angeles. That was really terrific for us because it really gave us visibility. And then we were chosen to be at IDFA, which is the documentary festival in Amsterdam, probably one of the biggest in the world, and an amazing festival with amazing documentary films, and that gave us a European presence. And then I was in a couple of other festivals because people asked, but those were the main three that really gave this film visibility. And of course, Larry does too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just the fact that he's willing to show up at some of the festivals and willing to do some press about it, at least got it into the dialogue, the documentary world and the dialogue about documentaries.
And the documentary form, I think it's thriving. We talk about this very often here on the show. We love documentaries, and I think the climate of the world stage right now and how unsettled everybody feels, that makes them drawn even more to the documentary form, some form of truth, you know, or an exploration of what is true. Do you sense that renaissance?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think, first of all, the fact that we can shoot digitally and not on film has opened up the genre for many, many more voices than would be able to, just because of expense. And additionally, there are such fabulous documentary filmmakers out there. I am just in awe of the other filmmakers. I'm constantly informed by them and motivated by them and inspired by them. And it's a wonderful community. A wonderful community.
Very much is. And will you be tackling, you mentioned the Ukraine, I don't know if you're returning that project, but will you be tackling another documentary next?
Yes. Actually, I have one that we did some shooting for on a Pulitzer Prize winner, Annie Wells, that we're in process of raising some funding for. And I'm also going to be working on something, and I'm in really early pre-production stages, but I want to do a film on women veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq and to talk about some of the unique issues they face when they return home, not only in terms of readjusting and post-traumatic stress syndrome, but medical care. As you know, this administration has a horrific record, as does John McCain, by the way, on supporting our veterans. And
that's a horrible irony that you bring up about Mr. McCain.
Yeah.
Oh, it's since 1996, and I got the data. You know, he has voted against health care, vets, and, of course, the most recent GI Bill, where he was against it, and then he was a no-show on the vote, and then Bush gave him credit. And this was a bill that was going to give vets full education, like John McCain got when he came back from Vietnam, or people got from, you know, post-World War II. And McCain turned it down, and Bush was against it as well. And their reasoning was, well, if we give them too many goodies, they won't re-up.
Mm.
And my point would be, well, if you've done four tours in Iraq, I mean, shouldn't they be the ones getting the golden parachute? Isn't two years enough?
If anyone gets a golden parachute, it's our veterans.
Right?
Yeah, it should be.
Yeah, it's, and you know, it's funny. Eventually you have to finish a film and put it out there, but I would so much like to go back into that film and add to it, particularly in terms of Larry, because he's actually, I guess, Hustler, the organization, is doing a film called Nayland Palin.
Yes, they are. Yes, you're absolutely right about that, miss.
I didn't think
you would bring that up, but, you know, my heart goes out to you, and you have my vote. for whatever you're doing, for bringing that up.
I'm not making film, of course.
No, but I didn't think that, but you just get massive kudos for bringing it up, though.
I'm not going to, yeah. Well, the plot is obvious, you know.
That's
renewable energy or something. I don't know, but I, you know, that would be, just as a filmmaker, to be sort of politically, you know, sort of in the now, I just think would be a very funny moment to put in a film. And, of course, Larry's views on this particular election. But, again, you have to finish a film and it has to be over and you have to move on.
Right.
You know.
But you do have a lot of interesting deleted items that were on the cutting floor on that DVD. Is there one in particular that stands out that you didn't include for one reason or another?
Oh, in the film? I will tell you, yeah. We came across, we had some footage from Larry's archives when he was in the psychiatric hospital. That was right after the DeLorean stuff and when he cursed out the Supreme Court and when he had the DeLorean tapes, and it was contempt of court, and he was put in the psychiatric ward. And we only had a few pieces of that. And so, you know, we included that in the film. Subsequently, I found something on YouTube that showed more of it. So I wrote the guy, said, where did you get that? And he said, well, it was on Court TV, best moments of Larry's, funniest moments in court, or, you know, in a deposition or legal moments. So I went back to Court TV, who are very fond of Larry, and I had used other stuff from them, archival stuff, and they found the deposition, which Larry didn't have, which were these, about 4 to 6 hours of him being deposed in the psychiatric hospital. And, of course, you know, we'd already, you know, finished the film in a way, but I was able to include, I cut some stuff out. I was able to cut the film shorter, which I think made it run better, and to include some of that in there. We just couldn't include all of it, but it is in the extras, and it is something else.
Fascinating stuff.
It really is, because he was, he denies it, but, I mean, he knew what he was doing. He was really messing around with them. He really wanted them to think he was crazy, but this man was also in great pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
He was, yes.
Mm-hmm. The film is called Larry Flint, The Right to Be Left Alone. If you click on the DVD cover icon there on our homepage, it'll take you directly to Amazon where you can purchase the film. You're doing great work, Joan, and please keep at it. It's important work. And thank you so much for being on our show tonight. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it so much. Thank you so much.
Come back anytime.
Oh, I will.
anytime, really. You're always welcome here.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Okay, have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye now. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Joan Brooker Marks, director of Larry Flint, The Right to Be Left Alone. It's a great new documentary. Okay, two great interviews so far.
Dude, I don't think this is one of the most exciting nights we've had in a while. Not that we've had, like, the last couple of months. I would have to honestly say, since we've been on a roll really since March, but this is just, tonight's been just wild so far.
Very,
I love
interesting.
It.
Can you tell it's an election year? Can you tell we're it's seeping into our show here?
Larry Flint has my vote.
Yeah. This next interview is pre-recorded. I recorded it about half an hour before the debate on Thursday night. It's a different point of view, and we bring in everyone on and welcome their points of view, as long as it has something to do with the film that they made. And this is the screenwriter of a new film that just opened this weekend. It's called An American Carol, which is basically being advertised as a parody of the left wing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big deal because it's a conservative point of view, which isn't normally presented in a Hollywood film, and which I think in itself is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So
it is healthy. Let me actually, it is very healthy to have that both sides presented.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone on the show has a problem with that. It's very important that there be some sort of balance.
Yeah, and I bring that up to her in the interview. And I know we have people in there in the chat room, or we did a little bit ago, that saw the movie and enjoyed it. They've been talking about it in the chat room. So enjoy the interview, and then Jerry and I will be back, and I want to discuss Religious with you. I have a couple of clips
to
play as well. Here is Myrna Sokol, I can't, my tongue is tied tonight for some reason. Myrna Sokoloff. And she has an interesting story. She's the co-screenwriter and executive producer of An American Carol. And let's hear that interview now.
Okay, it's the camera on. And action.
He's America's most infamous filmmaker.
Here I am in the island paradise, Cuba.
Totally arrogant.
I love America. That's why it needs to be destroyed.
And completely clueless.
We're the biggest slave owner in the state.
Don't you worry, Master Malone. Huh? We got them bacon stains out of the upholstery.
Oh. This time, he's finally gone too far.
We're going to abolish July 4th.
We're not shaving till they bring all the troops home.
Thank you, boys.
They're women.
And it will come back to haunt him.
Don't hurt me. I've always stood up for gay rights.
I'm the angel of freaking death, you turdhead.
Now, three American spirits.
I am General George S. Patton.
That'll explain a slapping.
Are determined to knock some sense into him.
Hey, you're not a spirit.
I know. I just enjoy slapping you.
And will teach him the true meaning of patriotism.
This is the greatest country in the whole wide world.
From David Zucker.
Muhammad.
The master of movie satire.
I must get his last names.
Hussein!
God's sake.
Comes an outrageous new comedy.
It is getting harder and harder to find suicide bombers. And all the really good ones are gone.
With Kelsey Grammer, Dennis Hopper, Trey Satchett, Leslie Nielsen, David Alan Greer, Robert Duffy, James Woods, Rosie O'Connell, and John Voight. With Kevin Farley as Michael Malone in An American Carol.
They can't see us.
Right. This is going to be harder than I thought.
You're the co-writer and executive producer of An American Carol, and you open this weekend. How are the nerves holding up? How are you feeling right now?
I'm actually feeling upbeat. I've been doing a lot of interviews all over the country, and people are really excited about the film, so that makes me excited. But yeah. At a certain point, you just say, we've done everything we can do, and now it's in God's hands, and the movie's going public.
Yeah. And tell me how this came to you, how this project came about, and did you consider a career in film? How long has that been a goal for you?
Well, I've been living in L.A. for quite a while. I was in politics before and in education and government, and so I've done a lot of things in my life, but I wanted to come to L.A. to be in entertainment, and I've probably written 7 screenplays before, but of course, like everybody living here, you know, they're sitting on a shelf, you know,
right.
and everybody's sitting at Starbucks, you know, waiting for their agent to call. So, but politically, I had always worked with the Democrats, and after 9/11, I became a Republican. I became a conservative, and then I eventually switched. And David Zucker was also the same thing, that after 9/11 he became a Republican, and we both joined the Republican Jewish Coalition, which we didn't even know there were other Jews that were Republican, because here it's all Democrats. So
right,
David,
right.
When he found out, he said, I Republican Jewish Coalition, that's like Indians for Custer, you know. We had so we did find other people that were like us, and they were nice, and we had people to talk to. And when we met, I had originally worked for Barbara Boxer here, our senator in California, and she had been calling him for campaign contributions, and he had to say no to her. So he thought, well, maybe I'll write her a letter, you know, and explain I support the president. So people put us together, and we never wrote the letter, but we came up with an ad to help the president in 2004. It was an anti-Kerry flip-flop ad, and it was very funny, and Club for Growth put it on all over the country, and we saw the reaction to using humor to express our political views, and we thought maybe we could write a whole movie, you know, like that, come up with a good story, and that's when we started writing the movie.
There's a couple of things that I wanted to know, and you touched upon it in your answer there. First of all, this you are in L.A. the Hollywood area, and to be a conservative or Republican, it's kind of its own secret society.
Yes, it is.
Why is that the case? Why do you think that people within the film industry tend to lean more to the left?
I thought about this a lot. I think it has to do with somehow they think, you know, their personal freedom and is somehow being impinged upon, you know, by conservatives. I think that has a lot to do with it. I don't want to touch on anybody's lifestyle or anything, but, you know, it's a world apart here, and people are very creative. They make a lot of money, and it's really not like the rest of the country, and they only talk to each other. So it is very liberal, and sometimes their view of the rest of the country is skewed, you know, because they only talk to each other in their world. But there is a big world between L.A. and New York, and it is the rest of America.
Well, that is definitely true. And you spoke about using this form, satire, to express your point of view. Is there something inherent in satire as opposed to drama that allows you to do more with that?
Well, I think we use the expression, you know, the emperor has no clothes. And
right.
We are taking things that we think should be exposed and doing it with humor. You know, finally calling out. After all, if you watch Saturday Night Live or any of the comics on TV, they are constantly making fun of the right. So we are just turning it around, and we are making fun of the left, things that we think are funny. And, you know, they can dish it out, so we're going to see if they can take it.
And this is a real kind of rarity that a film like this has come along, and I'm sure you've spoken to the fact that as you've traveled around and interviewed, people are very excited about this because their voice is finally being represented on the big screen.
Yeah.
Do you have that sense that this is a time that's it's about time it gets here for these people that feel like they've been neglected, at least in terms of the political views in the multiplex?
Yes, I think if you watch the movies that came out in the last year or so, there were so many movies, Redacted, Lions for Lambs, Valley of Elah, that was so anti-American and anti-troops. All the troops are either victims or criminals, or, you know, it was always a negative view. And, you know, thank God nobody went to see them. I mean, they had terrible box office, all of them, no matter how many came out. And, however, these movies got funded. These movies, studios funded them. They got distribution. They had big stars in them, Tom Cruise, Robert Redford, Meryl Streep. And then we wrote our little movie, and nobody would touch it.
Yeah.
And which is interesting, even though the box office is terrible for the left-leaning movies, is basically Hollywood's agenda. They believe in those movies. So we are coming out with this movie and saying, look, the other 50% of the country, more than 50%, agrees with us, and we want to see if they're going to come to the box office. Our producer is Steve McAveedy, who is the head of Empower Pictures. He was Mel Gibson's producer for a long time and produced Braveheart and When We Were Soldiers and The Passion of the Christ. So he knows what it's like to have a film that Hollywood says nobody will go to see, and then it makes $345 million.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good person to have on your side. let's talk a little bit about the filmmaking and the writing of this.
Mm-hmm.
When you write a satire, and obviously your partner here is David Zucker, he's the director of the film as well, and he has a tried and true track record in terms of hilarity on the big screen. Do you know that it's funny as you write it, or does it just have to have the potential to be funny?
Well, that's a good question, because with comedy, sometimes you write something that you think is just hysterical, and then you do a test screening and people don't even laugh at it. Or something you don't think is that funny, and then people are hysterical. So it really, with a comedy, you test it a lot in front of an audience.
But when we were writing, it is a takeoff on Christmas Carol.
Right.
And so we did have a little help from Charles Dickens. But it's not the night before Christmas. It's the night before 4th of July. And our Scrooge, of course, is a documentary filmmaker who's very controversial and trashes America all over the world. So we took this character. His name is Michael Malone, played by Kevin Farley, who's Chris Farley's brother.
Yes.
And we took this character, and then we just made him more outrageous, you know, and put him in situations that we thought were outrageous, but that we thought our 50% of the country was going to laugh at, for instance. Mm-hmm. We wanted to take on the ACLU, so in a PG-13 movie, you can't kill anybody, you know, you can't show you're killing somebody, so we made them zombies. They're the undead. So,
right.
So when Patton shoots them, he's not really shooting a person, he's shooting the undead. They're already dead, you know, and so it's a joke, you know.
Right.
But you know, people will laugh at it because they'll get it immediately what we're trying to say, that that's a joke to them, that
mm-hmm.
we're taking on the ACLU. Some things are just silly on themselves, you know, a guy's head being thrown in, you know, sitting at a table and his head goes in the cake, you know. So there's
right.
silly stuff there that's just silly in any movie. But then there are pointed jokes that are very political, but we make them so outrageous that that it's silly.
Yeah. And Mr. Zucker is famous for that, mixing the hysterical
yeah.
dialogue with the sight gags, and it's just, it makes your head spin. The laughs
yeah.
come so fast in his films. How did that writing process work out? I'm often curious when you're collaborating on a script, are you in the same room fleshing it out, or do you guys take separate pieces and work on them? How does that work for you guys?
No, well, actually, we would try to be together as much as possible, and we sit at the same table, and script would be on the monitor, and we usually either had an intern, you know, somebody typing, an assistant typing, and we would be yelling back and forth, you know, like what to say and what to write. Then we'd look at it, and then we'd say, no, this is too long, let's cut that part out, you know. But very often we just think of something, you know, that was outrageous, you know, and we'd put it in there. And sometimes it would just, I'm the more political one because I've had a lot of experience in politics, so
mm-hmm.
I would always, the other day he said, a couple of times he said, Myrna is like the political officer on the hunt for Red October. He kept me, you know, in line. No, you can't say this. No, you can't say that. And I would
right.
keep him on message, you know, that I would say, now what are we trying to say here? You know, why are we making this joke? Does it lead us to where we want to go on this? We have to make our points in this scene and then get out. So it was a combination, and sometimes I say it's like, this is like a Frankenstein monster, that we were taking body parts from two different bodies, my political humor and his silly stuff, and sewing it together and hoping it would get up and live as a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and you have a great cast to bring this film to life.
Yes.
Kelsey Grammer, John Voight, and Robert Davi, who I believe we're going to speak to next month about another film that he's doing, so I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, he did a great job.
Yeah, he's wonderful. And Peter Farley.
Kevin Farley,
I'm so sorry.
Right.
I'm wondering, I heard an interview with him earlier today, and he just seems like the sweetest soul. What is he like? Does he have that same kind of manic energy as his brother?
Yeah, I didn't know his brother, but
mm-hmm.
He says he's somewhat like him. But of course, I think they were a year apart. I think Chris was a year older. But Kevin is a hard worker. He's a really sweet guy, and he just is so great at comedy. I mean, once David and I met with him. We were given a reel of his stuff, you know, little clips of what he had done, and we met with him, and he did not want to tell us he was conservative, and we didn't want to tell him we were too conservative because we thought he was a Democrat, and he wouldn't want to play a role that was basically a Michael Moore parody. So we danced around it, and we said, you know, we support the troops, and he said, oh, yes, I support the troops, and we, you know, we were like, we didn't know what to say. And then he said, well, he's very interested, and, you know, he's kind of a centrist, and we said, we're a centrist, you know. So we finally gave him the script, and we told him not to give it to his agent because we didn't want it flying around Hollywood. And he read it, and he loved it, and he wanted to do it. And it wasn't until the first day on the set, I gingerly said, you know, Kevin, we might go to the Republican National Convention. I don't know what your politics are, but I don't know how you feel about that. He said, are you kidding? I never voted for a Democrat in my life. You're a conservative? You're a Republican? He said, yes, I didn't want to tell you because I didn't think you'd hire me. You know?
Oh, wow.
So I ran over to David and I said, you're not going to believe this. So that's how it is in Hollywood. We just, people don't say, you know, what they really are. But he was great on the set. He was practically in every scene. He worked so hard, and he is just a great comedian. He is just great.
Oh, I bet. And he spoke to that, too. He said that he didn't tell any of his friends that what he was doing for a while, and they thought that he was depressed because obviously playing a takeoff of Michael Moore, he has to have the weight and the slovenly kind of look.
Right.
Why? And you said that you didn't want the script to necessarily get out. Why was that important to keep this project under wraps as you did?
Well, we didn't want the rest of Hollywood to know. Because we didn't want people talking about it beforehand, and we thought the mainstream media and the mainstream Hollywood would start trashing it before we even made the movie. So we just kept it under wraps. We didn't let any of the normal, you know, Entertainment Tonight or Access Hollywood get on the set. You know, usually they do their interviews while you're filming, and then when right before the movie comes out, they put them on. But we didn't do that, and we just kept everything quiet. And now it's gotten out, you know, what it is. And we've had a few, you know, people write some stuff in our hometown paper, the LA Times. The title of the article was "The Republicans Are Invading." And I thought, that is really strange.
With their one movie.
Yeah, with their one movie.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
David has lived here for like 30 years, and I've lived here for 20 years. And the fact that they would consider us invading, and it's like, what are we, aliens? I mean, how dare we do this one movie that's conservative?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely right. And there are tons of films that come out with so-called liberal points of view, and some of which we've mentioned tonight, and I've always thought that it should be a lot more balanced because, you know, America is made of people on both sides.
That's right.
So, yeah, so why not have something for everyone? That's what's so great about films.
Absolutely, and we just feel, you know, they can make their movies, but we should be able to make our movie, too.
Yeah. However, I did hear an interview with Mr. Zucker, and he said he doesn't necessarily feel like he made a political film. He made a comedy, and I know it has to work as a comedy for it to work in any other area. I mean, that's the essential part. Do you classify it as a political film yourself?
Well, to me, I sort of come at it at a different angle. I feel it is a comedy, but we make political points, but we use comedy to make those political points. And he's always looking for things to laugh at, you know, to make fun of, and he made fun of disaster films and scary movies and everything. So this, to him, as a director, he's now found the left to make fun of. So that's the way he sees it, as comedy. But to me, it was more of a chance to say what I wanted to say, but using comedy to say it.
All right, that was the bulk of our conversation with Myrna Sokolov. The screen, I'm trying to unmute you, Jared. Okay, I think you're
okay. Can I speak? No, I just want to address something that kind of irked me about that.
Just what?
No, I mean, if you want. If not, I'll shut up. But
does it have anything to do with movies?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, she mentions Redacted, Lions for Lambs, and The Valley of Elah. The problem with the rendition, for that matter, the problem, these movies, regardless of their political point of view, some of them just weren't well done. I will say that they were not anti-American, though, any of them. They were not anti-troops. Even Redacted, regardless of what you're feeling, I don't think it's anti-troops. I'm not, and yes, I'm liberal. I'll say that right now. And I don't believe liberal is a dirty word, regardless of what people in the country may think. But it is not a dirty word. But they're not anti-American. I resent that.
Well,
I really do resent that you would think those are those films. And let me tell you something. There may not be a more patriotic movie in one sense of those films in The Valley of Elah, because it is the Tommy Lee Jones characters that, and I'm not a big Paul Haggis fan by any stretch of the imagination, but I think Tommy Lee Jones' character and that the fact that he plays that character is very telling, and his actions throughout the movies and what he has to do and how he changes are very accurate and very patriotic.
Liberal's not a dirty word, but the futurist is giving us examples of what are dirty words.
Thank you, futurist. I love you, baby.
Yeah, you know, I don't find that the case, and I don't think that's because I'm on the left, but, I mean, I don't find it the case that they're anti this or that. I find a lot of compassion, and I think the most successful of all of them is actually in The Valley of Elah.
Yeah.
I find a lot of compassion in that, and I think that, I was going to bring up Lions for Lambs, we both kind of disagreed on the effectiveness of it.
Right.
I was surprised by how balanced that was, obviously.
It's very balanced, regardless of what you may feel about the film. To walk away and say, oh, it's a liberal. No, I got to hand it to Redford. He made, and that was part of the criticism, if you'll remember, by some people, that it was too balanced.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing with the young kids that believe in what they're doing, and that's why they go to war. You know, and Redford tries to give his point of view, but he can't argue theirs.
I just wanted to say that because I just don't like to see. I mean, they're anti-American. I'm sure you can find something maybe in some very far left documentaries that maybe you can speculate that. But in the films that she mentioned, I'm sorry, I don't see it.
Yeah,
I really.
But
don't.
It is a. It's a minefield, man.
Oh, it is.
I feel bad for reviewers that have to kind of review some of these hot button movies. I mean, Passion of the Christ was an example years ago, and now we have all the political films, and you have to really tread a line, and you can't write well if you got to tread that line.
And I also have to say something else, and I am going to get a lot of trouble for this, and if you want to erase this, I'll understand. Look, I'm Jewish. And I think a lot of people already know that. And I lived through 9/11. It didn't make me want to become a Republican.
Yeah, it didn't make you, but it made her, and it made.
I know it made a lot of people though, and it's a thing that disturbs me. Because it's always something that makes me ashamed of my people when I hear this, because it's like what you weren't good enough before, you had to join this group that traditionally hates our guts. So. And I will say, I have no problem saying that.
I know you don't.
I had to say it because I've been quiet for the last 8 years about it, so I finally had to say something.
I really see gray in everything. And
I agree with I see it a lot. Gray
to
is
each
my
his
favorite
own.
Color.
I'll say I like, this has nothing to do with movies, and we're going to get off it right after this, but I like McCain, I like Palin, I like Bill O'Reilly. I just don't believe with much of their ideology. Ideology.
You had it right the first time.
So I mean I don't have to hate someone to completely dismiss someone to disagree with their views. To be honest, I watch Fox News more than I watch any other news network. I know how I feel about things, so I don't need to watch other news networks. I want to see what
right.
They
I understand. No, I hear where you're coming from.
Yeah. So speaking of this, I mean this is almost here on the same topic. Religious, which I was so disappointed. I drove an hour and a half out of town to go see it, and Chris, my friend Chris and fellow Movie Geek host, had the wrong showtime. So we
you had to bring that up on the air. You're not going to let him live that one down.
No,
oh, my God.
Absolutely not.
Oh, God, the next time he's on the show, it's going to be a bloodbath. Okay.
Right. But this is a movie that did extremely well. I think it was in just over 500 theaters, and it cracked the top 10. So it did well. Bill Maher, who, you know, you like or you don't like, but we happen to like him in his show on
HBO.
We
like him. And I didn't – I mean, I've always liked him, but I think ever since he started real time with Bill Maher earlier this decade, I think he's finally found, like, the perfect vehicle, the perfect forum. Because, I mean, where else can you watch a show where you can get Noam Chomsky and Gary Shandling? I mean, that's incredible to me. That's just awesome. I love that. Or
they're both extremely controversial figures.
Yeah, or Bob Woodward, or, you know, Alec Baldwin, or, you know, just anybody, Naomi Klein. It's just incredible. I love his the way this format is perfect for him, much more than Politically Incorrect ever was. But the documentary, I like.
Yeah.
I really like it. I actually wish he would do this more. I think he's tailor-made to this format. Now, is it a real documentary? I think it's more in the line of the Michael Moore type of documentary. He's the star of the show.
Right.
And he does a very good job. And I am curious, though, for some of the scenes, like if there wasn't a camera there, I'm curious if some of these people wouldn't have
punched his lights out. Yeah.
The one guy that you see in the trailer, that big guy says, if you start disputing my God, we're going to have a problem. I'm curious, if the camera wasn't there, would Mr. Maher be with us still today? I don't know. I do. He walks away.
I'm wondering that about the Sacha Baron Cohen Bruto.
I don't know if Mr. Cohen's going to make it. I really don't know. He's really pushing the envelope.
These are brave performance artists here. Look, Bill Maher's take, and I agree with maybe 60% of what he says, and he tends to go a little too far sometimes, but that's his play.
He is
a provocateur. That's what he does.
He does. He's like Michael Moore. He is a provocateur. In this, I mean, I think the last 10, 15 minutes of this film are going to piss off a lot of people.
Yeah.
He addresses the camera. He's like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, kind of anti-religious.
Yeah.
He really does. He does fall in that camp. You can't be middle of the road with him here. He really has no love for religion of any kind.
And here's a clip from Religious.
Bless me, Father. For I have sinned. It has been 40 years since my last confession. I hope this isn't lame, but I wrote it down. Did I swear? Yes. Do I work Sundays? Yes. Do I tell white lies? Yeah. Did I build a golden statue to praise another god? Of course I did. I don't think everything happens for a reason. I don't think there's good in everybody. I don't even think every life is precious, so I hope I'm not on your shit list already. There was a time in my life when I definitely should have used a rubber more. But you know how that is, Father. You use a rubber the first time because you don't know each other, and then you have sex for like 2 hours, and you go, boy, I feel like I really know you. I know that's wrong. And you know, quite frankly, I did. I shoplifted the booty quite a bit. Sorry. Okay, page 2.
Here's a clip from it.
Yeah.
The bottom line is it funny?
It is funny. And, you know, like I said, for me, it's like real time is, I think, the perfect forum, the perfect vehicle for him and for him to get his ideas across. Do I think he's full of himself in this documentary? Of course. I don't agree with everything he says. I was actually I was really cringed at some of the things he was willing to say to people in their face. I was just like, dude, do you have
is the Mossad
protecting you? I mean,
he is he's a smug SOB.
Oh, he is.
And sometimes sometimes that gets to me, but on the whole, I think he's very quick. And I laugh more at how quick he is in conversation than I do his opening monologue in his show. I rarely think the opening monologue is very funny.
I think the opening monologue is sometimes very forced. I think it's his interaction that, and you're right, it is his quickness, which is to be admired, and that's definitely the case here. But there's, I'm just like, you know, watching this thing, you can't help but cringe at some things. You're like, these are the things that we would never, regardless of your views on, you would never really think to actually say out loud. Well,
yeah.
Bill says them out loud.
Yeah.
I mean.
And does he think he's funny? Yeah, I'm sure. I don't think anyone goes into comedy without thinking they're funny. But there's a smugness that in the chat room here. Mark,
yeah, I think Futurist is right. He does. I do. He really does believe he's above everyone else.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting the time of year it is, and with religion, and I know this is very, very much timed with the election and the end of the Bush era, and a lot of the criticism has been, if you believe that the end of days is coming, should in your lifetime should you be a leader? And
right, right.
You know,
yeah.
I don't know, but I found a clip, and I think it's interesting, and it's from the West Wing, which is a very liberal TV show. I think it's one of the best TV shows ever on TV. But this is an interesting monologue about religion that I always thought was a highlight of the show.
Okay, cool. Play it.
Think of it what you will. Here it goes.
I'm sorry. You're Dr. Jenna Jacobs, right?
Yes, sir.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Forgive me, Dr. Jacobs. Are you an M.D.?
A Ph.D.
A Ph.D.?
Yes, sir.
In psychology?
No, sir.
Theology?
No.
Social work?
I have a Ph.D. in English literature.
I'm asking because on your show people call in for advice and you go by the name Dr. Jacobs on your show, and I didn't know if maybe your listeners were confused by that and assumed you had advanced training in psychology, theology, or healthcare.
I don't believe they are confused, no, sir.
Good. I like your show. I like how you call homosexuality an abomination.
I don't say homosexuality is an abomination, Mr. President. The Bible does.
Yes, it does. Leviticus.
18:22.
Chapter and verse. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions while I had you here. I'm interested in selling my youngest daughter into slavery, as sanctioned in Exodus 21:7. She's a Georgetown sophomore, speaks fluent Italian, always cleared the table when it was her turn. What would a good price for her be? While thinking about that, can I ask another? My chief of staff, Leo McGarry, insists on working on the Sabbath. Exodus 35:2 clearly says he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself, or is it okay to call the police? Here's one that's really important, because we've got a lot of sports fans in this town. Touching the skin of a dead pig makes one unclean, Leviticus 11:7. If they promise to wear gloves, can the Washington Redskins still play football? Can Notre Dame? Can West Point? Does the whole town really have to be together to stone my brother John for planting different crops side by side? Can I burn my mother in a small family gathering for wearing garments made from two different threads? Think about those questions, would you? One last thing. While you may be mistaking this for your monthly meeting of the ignorant tight-ass club, in this building, when the president stands, nobody sits.
Gotta love the West Wing.
Oh, dude, I gotta say, I have a confession about this. Now, I didn't always watch it during the Bush presidency because I was very depressed. But I, you know, this was a very good show. I'm ashamed it's still not on, but I, you know, when I'm hearing that, anyone who calls Dr. Laura out has my complete and lasting respect.
Right.
Oh, I mean, just when I used to work in book retail, her books flew off the shelves, and I just love hearing that.
It's a big debate that I don't necessarily think that Religious is a debate film.
No, it's not, Jamie. It's not.
Yeah, but it is definitely it's an important part of our country. It needs to be explored a lot more.
I agree with you.
By reasonable people.
Yeah.
And reason really usually just like the two-party system. Going back and forth, it's the same thing with religion, and I believe in, I have my beliefs, but I also see that the hypocrisy of some things, and like that clip points out, when you take something so literally,
mm-hmm.
when you buy the whole bit and caboodle, is that
right,
a phrase?
You're right. No, I agree with with you there, and we do need it really. You know, the sad thing is these documentaries, the more popular documentaries, I think they can be a good starting off point, but they're not as they're not real debates, as you say.
I don't think they can be.
They
can't. I don't think in this climate, and it probably never has been. We're rational enough to have a constructive back and forth on things.
Mm-hmm.
People that don't agree with Ma aren't necessarily going to go see this movie to challenge themselves. People that are confident in what they believe, whether it's with or against Bill Maher, will, I think. I mean,
yeah.
If you're really confident, hear the other viewpoint, just like I always watch Fox News. I mean, I want to hear the other
I read the
viewpoint.
Wall Street Journal. I disagree with the Wall Street Journal, but I read it on a daily basis.
Right.
Okay, so,
right.
I mean.
Yeah. It's interesting. All right, we started with Nicanora.
And we started with Nicanora, and we ended with Religulous.
Yeah, what a journey in between.
We've had a fantastic journey tonight.
Yeah, it's been an interesting show. Wednesday night. Who do we have Wednesday night? We have James Gunn Wednesday night, the director of Slither. He's involved in an upcoming project called
mm-hmm.
Scream Queens. He holds a record for a screenwriter with two consecutive number one hits at the box office.
That's
true. I think it was Scooby-Doo 2 and the Dawn of the Dead remake. I mean, how's that for versatility?
I mean, you could get the two opposite ends of the spectrum there.
I know. So he's going to join us Wednesday. And we have other guests, too. I'm sure of it. So we thank everyone for joining us tonight. We'll see you back Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern.
Thank you. Good night,
hey,
everyone.
Thank you. Good night, guys.
Good night.